Welcome to Packet Pushers, a data networking podcast where real engineers get together to talk nerdy. Yeah, it's a special place where we never have to apologize that you don't know what a packet or a router is, because we live in a virtual boardroom where we gather to wave our hands at the virtual whiteboard, breathe coffee-scented air that's full of networking terms, detailed technical information, and discuss technical topics that real people actually care about. Today is a chit-chat between Ethan and myself. So, without further ado, welcome Mr. Ethan Banks. How are you today?
Hey, Greg. How's it going? I'm staring out my window in my office here where there is no snow on the ground, which is absolutely bizarre for this time of year. It's just one of those weeks where we had a strange warm front move through, a lot of rain, and all the snow we had is now gone. Ooh. And I need to point out that you criticized me in a podcast we did a little bit earlier about my sunny disposition and outlook on 2013.
Yeah.
And I am here to tell you, with February having rolled around, I am still sunny and resolute in my tropical forecast for the year. It's still looking good. So take that, Arrow.
Well, I'm looking at my window, and it's dark. So, but there's no snow there anymore. It did melt. We had a very long winter here in the UK. So I guess I should get the V8 out and get some plastic McDonald's wrappers and you know, just keep it going. Because global warming is definitely not a thing, right?
No. it's just hysterical, hyperbolic exaggeration on the parts of people who wish to control the world.
That's exactly right. The flying spaghetti monster meant for us to have it. That's exactly what
that's
I think.
That's right.
The flying spaghetti monster wouldn't have sent it to us. That's what it is, right? If he didn't want us to have global warming, he would not have given us V8 engines and fossil fuels, surely.
Surely.
That's
absolutely correct.
So there you go. Well, as people can tell, there is nobody else to introduce. It's just Ethan and I this week. We've both been fairly busy. I particularly have just started a new role, which is, and I'm feeling like not only am I drowning, I wish my boss would take his foot off my head. I think he means it in a nice way, but it doesn't feel so great all the time. So I'm dragging my organizational skills for focusing on my day job, which I hope you'll bear with. But Ethan and I thought we'd get together and just talk about a few things that have happened in the last few weeks as a quick sort of a heads up as to what's been happening. I've recently been looking at software-based load balancers. My new role involves building cloud networks for a large-ish sort of a company. We are building vCloud 5.1, which has all the virtualization stack up and down. You don't have to know, as a networking guy, you don't have to know a whole lot about virtual networking. But the interesting thing I wanted to talk about this is that recently I've been looking at software-based load balancers. The F5 product has become overpriced for my... You laugh.
Well, I'm laughing knowingly because even on the I'm not doing it at cloud scale, I'm doing it at enterprise scale, and every time we need to buy a new F5 appliance, it's like, oh geez, really? I don't know where I'm going to find the budget for that, because they are bloody expensive, no doubt about it.
That's right. And when you're talking about buying 50 to 100 of them to embed in different parts of your infrastructure, you really can't consider an F5, because the price, you know, at that sort of a scale, you know, I'd like to get the better operations and the reliability and the confidence that I might get from an F5, but I also can't afford to pay that sort of price tag when I'm still booting up a service. So really, it's not possible to consider F5 because the pricing is, well, I'm convinced it's out of whack with what you're getting, basically, and I can't recommend that you'd buy one right now. Maybe F5 will get a dose of reality soon. So I've been out looking at a product called Stingray, and Stingray is owned by Riverbed. So it's a software-based load balancer that you install into a VM, and you have, you know, NICs that come in and NICs that go out, and this thing does load balancing. And it's got major instantiation, so it has all the things that you'd like to have about a load balancer. So it's got the basic layer 3, layer 4 load balancing, but the Stingray product goes all the way up to layer 7 in the stack and actually does WAF and application load balancing and all the things that you might think, including things like micro caching. So it has a small cache feature. Anyway, lots of good stuff. So when you actually get through the features, and then at a certain point in the presentation that I was going through, the customer said, yes, well, when Riverbed acquired the Zeus product, and it struck me that the Zeus load balancer is something that I've brushed over in the last 4 or 5 years. I've been regularly asked to evaluate the load balancing market for projects and stuff. And then I realized this is the old Zeus product that, you know, 2 weeks ago I wouldn't have bothered to look at because it's not from a major vendor. And now it's bought by Riverbed. I'm actually willing to consider it. I mean, how much does a vendor have on your confidence about what's behind the product? Am I being shallow by saying I wouldn't buy a startup product?
Well, part of the issue is who's going to back the thing, I think. So trying to make a purchase decision for something that's going to be a significant part of your IT infrastructure, you need to have the confidence that, A, it's going to be around for a while, and then, B, when it doesn't work right, which it won't because that's what it is. It's an IT product. You can call someone and get it going. And I think with startups, there's that kind of sense of, yeah, let someone else buy that and let them work out all the bugs. And in a few years, if it's any good, somebody big will buy them, and then I'll buy it, and it'll be okay. I don't know if that makes you shallow or not. I mean, is it shallow, or is it just having learned from experience over the years that IT products come and go, and you want to bet on as sure a bet as you can get?
I guess. I mean, there's a certain sort of confidence. Like a company that's big enough and large enough has resources, but the flip side of it, of course, is that Riverbed can just as easily toss products out the window as they fail. Like, for example, Cisco's Ace, it's not even on life support. It's just tossed out the back in a bag and rotting in the pile waiting for the garbage man to take it away. I mean, they still theoretically support it, and customers are still buying it because that's what they've got and it's working for them today. But at some point in the future, they're going to need to make a decision about, you know, putting a bullet in its head.
Well, would you have considered Viata before Brocade bought them, for example?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, as soon as Brocade bought Viata, that came onto my roadmap, and indeed is now. So Viata is, of course, a virtual appliance technology. It's software that runs inside of VMs. I need to deploy routers and firewalls and other appliances into that infrastructure, and Viata is a consideration.
You know, I can flip this around the other way, though, too, because you can take a product from Cisco. We both bought lots and lots of Cisco products over the years, and some of them have been absolute crap. Or even to pick on F5 again, it may be the product itself isn't crap, but a specific code release is. And F5, I can say from experience, every time you do a significant code upgrade, there is a lot of trepidation on the part of the engineer responsible for that appliance. Are all of my virtual servers going to function as they did before? Because as they change code, sometimes the upgrade doesn't go so well for your production environment, and it is a nerve-wracking experience. Or new features that they've introduced, which F5 has been very good about, that new and very useful features, but a lot of times in the early releases, they don't work so well. But yet we suck that up and take that as normal. I don't know. Maybe it is shallow to not give the startups a chance.
It's a difficult one, isn't it? You know, when you work for I've been working for largish sort of companies in the UK for the last 5 years, and you're expected to buy stuff from big companies. But I guess the other side of it too is that, you know, if Zeus was not bought by Riverbed and if it was bought by Juniper and I had an all Cisco strategy, you end up with interesting problems where, you know, you have a vendor strategy of this and they suddenly a competitor buys it. And now you've got to have a relationship with a competitor that you never, ever liked. So take, for example, recently Cisco bought Caradin. But I know that Caradin was a company that was very, very popular with Juniper MPLS backbone engineers because it did a really fantastic job on Juniper routers, far better than it did on Cisco routers, by what people tell me, in terms of mapping out pathing and getting good information back about the MPLS stuff. And yet Cisco's bought it. I imagine there's any number of annoyed Juniper people who think that this software, you know, this key software platform has gone away to some other party.
Thinking a bit broader, I'm thinking about the movement of OpenFlow, and part of what is driving that is people who don't want to deal with big vendors and pay high prices. They want to go kind of potentially a less expensive route with merchant silicon-based switches that let them do what they want to do using OpenFlow. And that's all bleeding-edge stuff. And talking to some guys this week about some of the challenges they've had as they're beginning to get right into what capabilities their switches have when they're implementing OpenFlow, what that really means, it's not like you're getting a fully baked product that can do everything you want. It's right out there on the edge. So, I mean, there are people that are willing to put into production systems that are not yet mature because they solve specific needs. And I think that's where startups fit in a lot of times. They're going to have a few big customers that are really keenly interested in this product to solve a certain problem. And it may not get broad market adoption for a while, but because it's solving the problems for a few people, initially, that's enough to get that startup company going and rolling and get the capital, the VC capital in they need to get started and so on. It's not like the product's junk. It just may not do everything that you want it to do because it's kind of focused on the problems of a few customers.
I just feel shallow for just because a big trusted company bought a product I would never have considered before doesn't suddenly make it better, or does it?
It means the support infrastructure is better, hopefully. And maybe it means there's going to be some wrappers put around it that make it more wonderful. But out of the gate, no, it isn't any different. It's going to get rebranded. It's going to get the marketing change, and that's it out of the gate.
Well, I guess the other side to talk about is the fact that, I mentioned that in the past I've always been a big fan of silicon-based networking and, you know, buying F5 load balancers in silicon to get an advantage of the performance. But what's also clear to me is looking at the F5 product is that their software-based platform is nowhere near as advanced as their hardware one. But Stingray, which has come from, this Stingray product, which has come from a purely software background, it's never been anything but software and runs in VMs and exists on Amazon, has all the things that F5's got without any of the limitations that hardware puts on it. I can put it anywhere in my VM infrastructure. It's changing the way I perceive networking is what I'm leading up to, is that the fact that I can have 50 software load balancers inside my VMware infrastructure automatically deployed as part of a vCloud application using a vApp changes the way I look at it, because if I have 50 VMs I don't have to keep finding ways to route the traffic up to the physical load balancer, and that changes the way way my network looks.
I'm interested to. I'll have to explore on the F5 side why you say the virtual appliance isn't as fully featured as the hardware appliance, because I have looked casually at the software appliance, but haven't quite bought it yet, because when they sell it to you, they sell it with traffic caps on it,
yeah.
Some of which has been kind of a turnoff. So it's kind of like, I'll pay a little extra and get a hardware appliance that gives me more long-term flexibility and so on.
That's a legacy way of business. I want to protect my hardware business, make sure that you buy hardware where you can. I don't want to embrace the cloud is basically what I'm seeing is, you know, let's stick with the old stuff. And it's sort of turning me off F5. I mean, I've been loyal to F5 over time, but that sort of limitation is a bit like Cisco's, when you're in San Diego and we're talking to the guys about the cloud services router, and they said, oh, yes, no, we'll sell it to you, but it'll be capped at 50 megabits per second.
Like, why? Why are you capping it?
Oh, well, because, you know, we don't want to undermine the ASR 1000 and 9000 sales. And I'm going like, I don't want an ASR 9, you know.
Exactly. You're not undermining anything. It's a different application. You're solving a different problem with the cloud services router, effectively.
That's right.
And saying router, geez.
So, but the interesting part is that VMware has now developed a thing called the vShield Edge, which is their networking stack, which actually does all of the layer 3 routing that you need. You don't pay for it, and it's automatically deployed as part of a vCloud. So for me to actually now go and consider the cloud services router means I actually have to go to a great deal of extra effort to deploy it, because I have to add it on as an aftermarket type thing. It's not a feature that's not there, therefore I have to have it. It's a feature that comes later. That was a bit of a surprise for me to realize that when I was doing the design for this current thing.
Now, with the Stingray, is the network that you're dealing with multi-tenant, where you might want to spin up a Stingray instance for one specific tenant?
Yeah. So we've currently got 10, I think, or 15 tenants in the current build, and we're migrating them to the next gen, which will be for, I think, 250 tenants is the current targeted architecture. So we could have, 250 load balancers for 250 different customers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, if I was to do that in an F5, they'd want me to buy a Vibrion. And,
yes, yeah.
There's a half a million quid, whereas with the Stingray, I just keep deploying it, and then as soon as I buy it and instantiate the entrance, the license, I take a server and then send it a report off to the licensing system, which then says this is how much we have to pay this month.
Hmm. So you don't have to license in advance. You basically go on the honor system, report, and pay in as you go.
Yeah, that's right. So we register as a cloud provider, which is not necessarily something a customer would get. So because we're a service provider, we would actually instantiate a Stingray, and at the end of the month, a report would go off saying, we have this many running instances, this is how much we owe you. They might come in and do an audit every now and then or something, but that's basically how it's done. So I don't have to go and find a half a million quid's worth of budget up front to buy a Vibrion chassis with just one F5 in it, one blade.
And this architecture you're describing really goes to what we're seeing a lot of, where all of the intelligence and the heavy lifting and packet manipulation is getting pushed out to the edge, mm-hmm. and all you've got in the middle, the core of the network, if you will, is just throwing packets through really fast and not having to think about very much anymore. All the rich services go out. Service chaining becoming a big thing. Yep, we're going to do it all at the hypervisor. We're going to chain up security, and we're going to chain up switching and whatever else we might need. And the core, all we need you to do, core, is just push packets through really quick.
Yes.
Yeah.
And in fact, that's a hobby horse I've been on this week. So I wrote an article for Network Computing where I talk about the Nexus 6000, which was released. So you and I had a briefing this week. And on Monday, I'm not sure, Monday the 4th of February, the embargo comes off, but which will be after we talk about this podcast, and Cisco will have released the Nexus 6000. And I got to see it while I was in London at Cisco Live. And the Nexus 6000 is a new chassis-based switch from Cisco, which is pure 40 gig. That is, it has no 10 gig interfaces. It's just, if you can imagine a 4RU block, and then the left-hand side comes with fixed 48 by 40 gig ports. And then the right-hand side takes another four modules. And today you could go and buy another four modules of 40 gig to give you another 48. So that's 12 40 gigs per slot to give you 96 ports of 40 gig in a single chassis. Now, you can get 10 gig out of it, which is pretty interesting. Which, for those of you not familiar, 40 gigabit Ethernet ports use a QSFP. So the actual PHY layer of a 40 gig Ethernet actually consists of 4 by 10 gig channels. So you can basically put a fancy connector in, which breaks out each of those 1 by 10 gig channels. And then you just connect those down to FEX 200s, FEX style to a Nexus 2200 or a Nexus or Ethernet style to a Nexus 5500. So now we've had this discussion before, Ethan, that the Nexus 5500 is a layer 2 switch, but not so great at a layer 3 routing stuff.
No, it is a layer 2 switch for line rate, and it, like the 5596 chassis, does full line rate bidirectional 96 ports. But if you want layer 3 services, there you bolt on a daughter board or you insert a module, depending on if it's a 5548 or a 5596. And so, it's bottlenecked. It is not line rate layer 3, so its applications then are limited as compared to the 6000, which is line rate.
Yeah. So the 6000 is a line rate layer 3, but it's the way the product manager described it to us on Monday was that it was more based on the 5500 code, the Nexus 5500 code, than the Nexus 7000 code.
It's somewhere in the middle, right? It does sound like it's its own code train, but that the code was based more on the fixed chassis 5500 than the 7K. I don't know if it would have a smaller feature set. Certainly doesn't have to deal with as many line cards and unique things coming at it that way. Perhaps the code is more stable. Perhaps the code is easier to upgrade, therefore.
Which brings me to my beef, which is that the Nexus 7000 has been causing me pain for a couple of years because it's so complex. So at a previous site, I had a Nexus 4.1 deployment that was done quite early, and the change management people had decided that because the Nexus 7000, there was a pair of them in the core of the network, and any change to that could actually take out the entire data center. Therefore, it was just too risky because we couldn't give them any guarantees about those.
Now, that you could guarantee the upgrade process, but you couldn't guarantee once the upgrade process was complete that the new code would be forwarding traffic in a consistent, reliable manner.
Well, there was a couple of things going on. The line cards needed new EPLD, and we engaged with Cisco, and Cisco told us that it would take 5 hours to do the EPLD update, and then the code update could take anything up to 2 more hours.
Jeez.
So the actual update window was expected to be anything from 4 to 8 hours. There was no guarantees.
If it went well.
So each line card in a 7000 actually has its own firmware on it,
mm-hmm.
and it takes about 40 minutes for the code to copy across the internal bus, and it takes about another 20, 30 minutes for the code to get into the box, and then the blade has to reboot to run the new image. And then once it's rebooted and loaded the flash firmware, then it goes back to the supervisor and loads its onboard firmware. And so it's 40 or 50 minutes to update a blade if you need to update the EPLD. But the EPLD software on the blade has to be in lockstep with the supervisor. There's a certain amount of matching that has to go on.
Yeah,
so they're cross-dependent. And what's happened
is the same thing with like a 5500 with a fax. The fax gets upgraded when the 5500 gets upgraded. So it's the same element of risk there that you're dealing with.
And the trick was, of course, is because we have two Nexus 7000s, we couldn't just upgrade one of them because they're running MLAG. So they're running VPC and sharing ports. And Cisco wouldn't make any guarantees to us that having one version running 5 or 6 and Nexus OX this and the other one running 4.1, you couldn't run one of them at the latest version and one at the old version. You had to do both at the same time because VPC requires the two systems to work as a coherent pair. I am now reasonably bitter about the 7000s as a single pair at the core of my network because that upgrading becomes risky. And the second thing that struck me was, the Nexus OS 6 train now has MPLS, it now has the NAM module. So second part of the Cisco announcement was that they've got NAM modules included in there.
Yeah, the network analysis module that would also do, it would tear off the covers of some of the overlay protocols like VXLAN and I think GRE and there were a few other ones and let you peek inside the packet and look at the payload and do full traffic analysis on it.
Yeah, I've been a big fan of the NAMs in the past, but they come with a generous price tag, and I'm no longer looking at those because they're just so overpriced for what they are. Fundamentally, they are an Intel motherboard put onto a blade which goes inside a switch. Now, I've worked in organizations where it's very, very difficult for me to put something in a data center, to put a new server or a new blade, you know, to put an appliance in, but very, very simple to add a blade to an existing chassis. And I've used NAM modules, and I like them, and I like the software. So don't get me wrong, but the pricing on a NAM module is very generous to Cisco. I generally don't look at them unless I've got no other options.
Plus, of course, it's expensive real estate. Now, if you want it in your 7000 and you're willing to give up a slot for it, great. Mm. And I think that's why Cisco gets away with pricing it the way that they presumably do. Did you actually get pricing on this module, the NAM X1?
It's not announced yet. They're just announcing the product. Yeah. They're not announcing the pricing.
Since it is fitting into a very particular place in your network and therefore has some unique ability to inspect traffic without you having to offload it through like a network visibility fabric like Gigamon or Anui, a product like that, then you kind of have a special invitation to the party to look at the traffic that's flowing through that 7K. And the fact that it does this deep payload inspection for encapsulated traffic, I actually brought up the list. It's OTV, Fabric Path, TrustSec, and VXLAN are the four that they had listed, and maybe there's something else as well. That's powerful and useful. And other stuff is going to potentially have trouble doing that, especially with TrustSec, I would think.
You've got to have access to make TrustSec work. You've got to have access to the crypto keys and to be able to decode the Ethernet at wire speed. The only place you're going to get that is inside the chassis.
That's my thought.
Yeah.
Sure, they're going to get away with it being expensive and then eating up a slot in your chassis, but clearly there's demand for it. But interestingly, as they were talking to us about this, they were suggesting that, yes, the NAM module is first, but it's really one of many services modules that are yet to come for the 7000. So rolling it back around to your original point, the 7000 platform isn't getting simpler and more straightforward. It's getting even more complex depending on what services you roll out with this thing.
That's right. And, and when the 7000 came, they said, this is the Windows 7000. I don't know if you remember back in 2009 when the 7000 arrived, they said, here's how we want you to imagine the Nexus 7000. It is your very fast, very scalable Ethernet and rooted IP core. If you want to have your fancy services, then you put them over here on your 6500 at the side.
That's right.
So now the Nexus 7000 has all those fancy services. And the more I put those fancy services into my pair of core switches, the less reliability I build into my network, because you've got to actually have one pair of 7000s for core switching, or the Nexus 6000, which is where I will probably go. And I have to have another 7000 over there with all the costs associated to buying a chassis and the software licenses and the maintenance costs. And that's where my NAMs and my, these other blades that are coming for the Nexus 7000. You know, we've heard different rumors about them, you know, the ASA blade and so forth. Whether they'll ever arrive or not, who knows? I personally don't think so. I don't think that hardware firewalls have a future. I think that we're sort of at peak physical software at this point in time.
So this, I'm glad you said that. I was going to ask you for an opinion on something, which is going back to the idea of the soft edge and the rich services that are living out in software. What custom silicon is really required anymore? What silicon do you want to dedicate to a specific network function? I mean, an ASA appliance is nothing exotic. An F5 appliance is nothing exotic. It's just Intel on the inside running their big IP OS. All the magic happens in software on that box, which is makes it easy to virtualize. Why, at this point, do you make a dedicated appliance? A lot of it's just commodity hardware that they throw their software on and a fancy bezel on the front and some network interfaces in it.
Yeah.
So
it's getting harder to see the value of that. I want to try and be careful here because I'm be distorted by the fact that, you know, currently 12 hours of my day is built around a virtual networking infrastructure where I'm making a decision to deploy no physical hardware simply because it's faster. I can accelerate deployment by not having to find time to buy a physical piece of hardware, ship it to my data center, rack it, power it, get access to it via an out-of-band, plug a terminal server into it, then update it, and then hook it into my orchestration system via a custom IP address, right?
Minus the orchestration system, you just described what I have to do at an enterprise level, let alone cloud scale.
That's right.
I do exactly that. I get stuff that shows up in a box. I got to configure it, ship it out to somebody. Uh-huh. I got to configure it at least enough that I can get to it remotely, ship it to somebody, have them hook it up. Then it takes up rack space. Then it takes up power. Then there's migration of cabling and, you know, whatever else that may need to go on if I'm doing a forklift upgrade. And so on. It's a big pain in the butt. If I could roll it all and say, hey, I need you to deploy this VM for me, then I start throwing traffic at it. That makes my life a lot easier.
It does. And the flip side of it is that, so for example, an F5 load balancer or an ACE might be able to handle 10 or 20 gigabits per second of load balancing of traffic, okay? But an Intel server, you know, it's not 100% clear to me how much traffic I could get out of a VM, but if I could get 2 gigabits per second out of a VM, is that enough? Maybe 1 gigabit per second of load balance traffic. Well, actually, that's quite a lot of traffic for most people.
It is, especially if the way to scale it is just to instantiate another virtual appliance and begin to push some of the traffic to the other, the new instantiation. You can scale that, in theory, infinitely, as big as your bare metal infrastructure will allow.
That's correct. Now, so I could have one or two or three or four virtual load balancers, or I could get my VMs and just continually increase from one to two to four virtual CPUs, or just increase the memory from one to two to four gigabytes. Because they usually don't use hard drives, so the disk space isn't usually a consideration. So most data centers today have like a services layer, an external services layer, where the internet connectivity and the WAN connectivity comes in. Mm-hmm. And today we deploy, you know, VPN concentrators and routers running MPLS to separate out the traffic flows and firewalls and load balancers and all that sort of stuff. This idea is just put a VM solution up there and start instantiating software instances. So instead of having one F5 physically somewhere in your network and having to try and force traffic into it, just bring all the VLANs into the VM and have 10 load balancers, one for each service. And because they're small, they should be reasonably cheap to license.
Yeah, of course, that is the one downside is, well, what does it cost to license this? And
yeah.
I know, well, going back to F5, because, hey, let's beat on them today.
Yeah.
You do pay significant money to have the virtual appliance licensed correctly. So
the flip side of this is if you've got 10 virtual appliances, when you go to do a code update, your change process just became a lot easier, didn't it? Because you're only affecting a service every time.
Especially if you spread the load of services across multiple virtual appliances, you've reduced your risk as well.
Yeah. So you could say, well, I've got to spend all week upgrading my F5s. Well, you know, I'll tell you what, maybe I'll do every Monday I'm going to upgrade one of the 10. And, you know, so let's say you've got 10 of them. So for the next 10 weeks, every Monday morning is upgrade the F5 and then wait for the pain, you know, something worse, stop working or whatever. And that's called continuous delivery. This is where I'm moving away from is today upgrading an F5 or a Nexus 7000 is like being constipated. I've got all this stuff, and then I have to go and get this huge, like, you know, push really, really hard, and out comes this big stinking pile, you know, and that's the change control process. It's like being super constipated. But what happens is because it's so challenging to get a change control and get a change window and then get into the – and because Cisco won't guarantee me – the Nexus 7000 upgrade process is reliable. You know, it, just to add in this particular case, at a recent customer site, we said to Cisco, okay, look, we accept the fact that you say that your software doesn't work and it's best effort and you can't guarantee us. Is there some testing you can do that would improve things? And they proceeded to offer us a proposal for just a shade under £600,000, that's $900,000, for the reseller to develop a testing plan and to go into a Cisco professional services lab where they would run the test plan. So I said, well, what would this test plan consider? You know, and the test plan was basically, you know, enable VPC, plug in a 5500 and check it turns on and off, you know, and check that it works. You know, we'll do the code update process and check that it works.
The plan's gonna, they have no secret sauce there. The plan's going to be the same thing you'd do if you had a full lab and could implement your own testing procedure, build in your own steps, put in your checkpoints along the way to validate the thing. I don't mean the firewall. I just mean a logical checkpoint to validate.
Yep.
This executed properly.
No. They weren't even going to do that. They were going to build a model. So what are the features that we wanted to have tested? So, you know, VPC, VDCs. There was a bit of multicast in a couple of VLANs. It was just localized, nothing too significant. You know, nothing really complicated because ultimately the Nexuses were running 4.1. So they wanted to charge £600,000. And I said, well, that's fine. So what sort of guarantees are you going to give us? You're going to insure us against any failures or will you take some sort of joint responsibility? No. We can't guarantee what would happen in a real network. Therefore, we can't give you. So I'm stuck saying to the boss, yeah, Cisco says if we spend $600,000, they might discover some sort of flaw, but they won't give us any more guarantees than they're already giving us. And the reseller, of course, was a hopeless twat. They could barely spell Nexus. They didn't even know what technologies were. The architects knew more about the technology inside the Nexus than the reseller did by a long, long way.
At the end of the day, it kind of means you're frozen in time on that Nexus. You're never going to be able to upgrade it unless something happened to them that forced you to have to upgrade them, like you know, some egregious bug or security vulnerability was discovered or something.
Yeah, so big shout out to Chris. Good luck, buddy. Sometime in the next 10 years, you're going to have to upgrade it, but it's not likely to happen. I suspect you'll retire before it gets any update. But good luck with that, because the reseller wasn't willing to take the risk and Cisco wasn't willing to make any guarantees. And the company says they've got a very, very strong ITIL change management process, which is retarded, of course, but there you go. I learned better lessons from that. You know, if you have a pair of – see, 10 years ago when I put a pair of core switches in the network, we used to be able to go in at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday and start the upgrade. And if there was any problems, we'd fix it, you know, on Sunday, right? But today, I'm working on, you know, this was a financial customer. To boot that switch down, to do those upgrades, represented taking an entire one of the top banks in the country offline. The vendor was giving me zero support. The reseller was giving me zero support. So I've now got a switch in my network which is already obsolete in terms of software. The vendor no longer supports the software version that's on it, but I can't update it to the latest version. because the vendor won't support me to update it.
It's interesting the dependency that's been introduced here with MLAG. And let me explain what I mean. Now, I'm thinking back to a financial services environment that I supported for about 4 years when I would plan a core upgrade. The methodology was swing traffic to one of the cores, upgrade the other one once you've confirmed there's no more traffic flowing through it, upgrade it, swing traffic back to it, test, and then upgrade the other one, normalize traffic, you're done. Okay. Now, yeah, I'd be doing that at 2 a.m. and or whatever off-peak time was considered to minimize potential customer risk. But because the protocols we were relying on were pretty boring, an IGP routing protocol and, of course, spanning tree, and little else beyond that that was super critical to the forwarding path, it was a straightforward exercise to know when and how to move traffic and to verify that, yes, indeed, traffic had been moved and minimize the risk of the upgrade process in that way. Once you upgraded the other, the core switch and normalized traffic, you weren't worried about, oh, there's mismatched versions. I mean, it's friggin' spanning tree. It's a routing protocol. You know,
the frame's going to come in. It's going to go out the other side. The IP address. Yeah, IP's going to come in. The worst that could happen is that HSRP would get out of sync or something, you know.
Maybe.
So that was years ago.
Now you throw MLAG in the mix, and it's proprietary vendor MLAG. It's Cisco VPC in the case of what you were talking about. Or it's, you know, every vendor's got their own flavor of MLAG, multi-chassis link aggregation. Then now we don't know if we want to support MLAG if the versions are mismatched. I mean, F5, not talking about MLAG anymore, but I do have the same problem with F5. If I upgrade a high availability pair of F5s, the actual upgrade process that F5 describes to go from Big IP version 10 to Big IP version 11 says, upgrade your standby, make sure all your stuff got upgraded well so all your virtual servers are there and your pools are there and they're ready to take traffic. Unplug the network for your version 10, plug in the network for your new version 11 now, and hope everything goes well. If everything's been going well, then go ahead and upgrade the remaining appliance. There's no stateful failover? No.
No.
You literally say unplug and replug cables.
Yes.
Wow. It couldn't be more painful or more graceless than to force a customer to do an upgrade in such a way when you invest in the high availability technology to have stateful failover. It's ugly.
It's fate sharing. You know, you can't have – so where they were two individual switches, they're now tightly bound together. And this is part of my whining about the Catalyst 6500 is the next generation of Catalyst 6500 will actually use dual switching fabrics on the dual supervisors. So you'll have the actual CPU engines. There'll still be two supervisors in the 6500, but both switching engines will be active to give you the necessary switching capacity in the next generation. So if one of those supervisors fails out, you lose half of your switching capacity, switching and routing capacity in that chassis. Now that's pretty key. So let me just give you. Let's come back to the Nexus 6000 and something similar there. So the Nexus 6000 has 128,000 TCAMs, or it has 128,000 entries in the MAC addresses in its table, except when it's running IPv6, in which case it's 50,000. But what actually happens is the TCAM table that's actually inside the Nexus 6000 actually has a total of 256,000 entries, and the actual capacity of the TCAM varies according to what it's used for. So if you're using multicast routing, you might have 10,000 multicast routes. Well, you've just lost 10,000 entries in your TCAM because the multicast routes are taking it up. If you're doing other things like summary routes or stuff like that, then that's chewing up space in your TCAMs. It feels to me like Cisco's cheaping out on TCAM, right? So instead of just saying, we've got this much of this and this much of this and this much of this and you can use it all up, they're making that TCAM flexible. So you get this marketing number. We get 256,000 entries, which is 128K default carving for Mac and 128K for IP routes. But you can set it up whatever you like. But do you remember on the 3750 there was this mode where you had to set it up to do – and you had to reboot it to re-architect the CAM?
Yeah, it's a switch profile. It's the NDM profile, something like that. But you can set about half a dozen or eight different modes that the switch operates in that reallocate TCAM so you can run IPv6 and IPv4 in a compromised kind of a state. And there are other flavors of it. But yes,
So now I no longer know, exactly where I am with my Nexus 6000. And if I'm going to re-architect my TCAM, can I do that on the fly, or does that require a reboot like 3750 did?
So here's a question then. In your mind, how are you positioning the 6000 as a core aggregation, as Cisco suggested in the call we were on, or edge?
I see it as a leaf spine / cloth fabric architecture for Ethernet and IP.
So in that role, how many routes do you need it to scale to for your application? Because to my way of thinking, you get up over 100,000 routes. That's a lot of entries. That's a lot.
Yeah. Except it's not. Because if you think that you've got a VMware infrastructure and you're starting to run VXLAN in the overlay, right, then you actually want to start having / 32s for every one of your hypervisors, because you don't actually want to have a layer 2 at all. Everything's a / 32. That's very common. So, for example, as I understand, Amazon Rackspace, Joyent, you know, those types of people, they have no layer 2 segments at all inside of their thing. Every host is a / 32 host root. And then they use an overlay network coming off those VMs, right, off the hypervisor.
Yeah, and I guess in my mind, I would think that the overlay network would hide a lot of that, so that the core would just be dealing with overlay endpoints and not what's inside the overlay. And so, therefore, you could reduce core routes quite a bit in that way.
Sure, but in my case, we're still talking about a lot of hypervisors. So 128,000 is a lot, don't get me wrong, and it sounds like a lot. And with careful design, like if you figure that in a cloth-based fabric, you know, where you've got four Nexus 6000s across the core, right, and then you might have, say, 24 5500s down at the next layer as top of rack, then, you know, you can have a lot of servers in there that do start to approach that. What Cisco's saying is that you should still have a 7000 in the core and use a 6000 as an ag layer and turn up fabric path, and you won't actually need to see all 1,000 MAC.
Right,
you won't need to see every MAC address in the network, because you only need to see what you need to see, so you don't need the whole capacity. But what happens now is, in my infrastructure, I now have to go out and research how the MAC table allocation works. Every time a new Nexus 6000 software version comes out, I have to check that Cisco didn't do something new, so I have to put in a quality assurance process into a testing routine, right? And this is literally, I have to document all of this stuff. And then what I also have to do is I have to create a software project to actually monitor the MAC table to check that it's not being exceeded.
Because it is a, if you will, a shared TCAM infrastructure as opposed to dedicated amounts of TCAM for specific functions.
Boom. So I can't just say poll that variable and check the TCAM's not being exceeded. I now have to write a software development thing to actually monitor the total TCAM space, and then have a constant active review process in my to-do list to go back and look at what the TCAM architecture is and to check whether it's the right one or the wrong one. Now, the flip side of this is that I also know that in 2013, there are TCAM designs out there that solve all these problems, and Cisco's not got them.
Who's got them? Are you suggesting this is merchant silicon-based
I don't
approaches?
Know.
That
I could make something up. I could just make stuff up on the spot. My guess would be is that the silicon inside the Nexus 6000 was put together 5-8 years ago, you know, whatever it was, a long time ago, in silicon terms. And
you know, there was a huge lead time on the Nexus 7K for darn sure, I think 2000, 2001.
Well, they started off the process when the silicon locked in was probably, you know, later than that. But, you know, let's say that the silicon architecture was put together 5 years ago, and then, you know, maybe they intended to get it there, you know, the software, original software development process was that this would come to market in 2 years, maybe three. But Cisco software development always runs late. And so instead of taking 2 years to write the software, it's taken five.
So does the 6000 have a home for you then? You cough, you go right ahead, get it all out.
Well, for those of you who don't know, I'm struggling with a head cold. I picked up at Cisco Live this week, so I was in London.
The first mass of humanity made you sick.
Yeah, so I'm just struggling with that, and I'm getting a bit dry from all this talking. I think the Nexus 6000 is pretty exciting. It's 40 gig, it's got 100 gig coming in 2014. It's got non-blocking line rate. I'm hoping the product stays simple and they don't start shoehorning in, you know, kitchen sinks. Like, the Nexus 7000 just doesn't have a kitchen sink. It's also got a, plate holder on the side, a nice little fluffy brush, some rubber gloves, you know, and a whole bunch of utilities to actually do the washing for you. And that complexity is beginning to chase me away from the 7000, because the more features they shoehorn in there, the more bugs we seem to have, and the more memory leaks.
The 6000 did strike me during the presentation as more focused, more specific purpose.
Yeah.
Let's throw traffic around really fast and scale it big and give you a lot of port density that will run at line rate for you and not take up a half a rack while doing it.
That's what I'd like to think. I'd be really pleased to think that that's what Cisco's planning on doing. So I could have a switch in the core of my network, which is just doing Ethernet and just doing IP, and they're not going to try and drape tinsel over the top of it and charge me extra like the 7000.
And well, the early form factors, I mean, you know it can't. There's just there's no line card expansion capability that's in there for anything weird. It's just going to give you more port density. It seemed like that would be about it. Not like a 7000 where now you can use up a slot and do NAM with it or whatever the other services are that are coming.
That's right. There's more coming. But over there on the right side will be my Nexus 7000 on a stick that's doing all my silly stuff. My MPLS, my OTV, my VDCs. Blah, 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 if that's what matters to you, right? But I don't want to do – what I don't want to do in my new – in my nice, shiny, software-defined data center world is I don't want to use hardware VDCs anymore because to my mind, that's an obsolete security mechanism because I can't change it very easily. I don't need that VDC feature that I was really excited about 4 or 5 years ago doesn't excite me anymore. Because I'm going to change my security to not have physical separation. I'm going to instantiate a different security mechanism that doesn't rely on physical perimeter security like is delivered via VDCs. Yesterday's.
It seems like the necessity to be able to spin up services securely and to do it fast and in an orchestrated way necessitates having these functions happen in software. In other words, you can't say I'm going to spin up a new VDC every time, which had licensing and scale limits. I don't know how many VDCs you're going to run on a 7000, but there's a limit to it. If you move all that functionality out to software, and if you have the same ability to secure traffic and keep everybody separated in a way that meets standards and policies and compliance requirements and so on, why wouldn't you do it that way? Why wouldn't you just want to keep the core simple and keep the complexity out at the edge and let an orchestration tool manage it? And I think that seems to be the message I keep hearing over and over from the SDN vendors. What they want to sell you.
And it is, right? So I can remember, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago, going hell no, how fantastic silicon was and how much better in speed and all that sort of stuff. But where I am right now, the more I can do in software, the faster I can move. Now, let me also say something struck me while I was doing something today is that I do also fully expect that silicon will do something for us in the near future. So I don't think that software is the only way. I believe that ultimately silicon will catch up with software. But it's going to take some time, and it's going to be longer than I think. It's not going to be a year or two before Cisco manufactures the next chip, or Intel's got networky. They bought Fulcrum, so they've now got that merchant silicon stuff. I think it's going to be 5 or 6 years before silicon comes back to the fore, and we have chips or servers. Or I wrote an article recently on Ethereal Mind where I talked about open compute servers. That Facebook is doing, and Facebook's sort of trying to push out a standardized hardware platform. And what they're actually doing is putting 3 servers wide in one RU, and then you can run them 48 high. So you can have 144 Intel servers in one rack.
Yeah.
Now, admittedly, that's going to draw an awful lot of juice, right? And most of us don't have data centers that can run at that sort of density. But, you know, have a look at the open compute. Now, imagine if I could give you 20 RUs of servers. Let's say we just go half, right? 20 RUs of servers, there's 3 servers per RU, so there's 60 servers. I'm going to have some sort of hypervisor, let's say it's KVM or VMware or CloudStack or whatever, and on top of that I'm going to have an orchestration system. So you can literally like click a button and a load balancer will instantiate inside of that. And then coming in, there'll be physical networks feeding into that rack, and there'll be physical networks going on into the rest of the data center. So in there, you can run all of your MPLS termination, SSL termination, VPNs on those 60 physical servers. Do you not want that? I do.
It seems like the logical progression. It's it's the why wouldn't you do that, I guess, becomes the question. Why wouldn't you? Now, I know talking to some guys in the EDU field this week and being a fly on a wall on a couple of phone calls, I know you were talking about the silicon not needing some evolution here, and we're not sure how long it's going to take, and that seems to be true with vendors that are doing OpenFlow and adding OpenFlow capability to their switches. Well, their ASICs weren't designed to do OpenFlow, and so how the OpenFlow spec is implemented in their switches ends up being a combination of matching that they can do in hardware, matching of specific tuples as defined in the OpenFlow spec. So it's a mix of doing that matching in hardware, and if they can't do it in hardware, doing it in software, which means it's not fast. it's not usefully fast. You can put some traffic through, and it meets the OpenFlow spec, but it is not speedy. So matching on certain tuples is almost useless, depending on what your application is. Now, new silicone coming to address that would, again, would reinvigorate a switch to be able to do all kinds of fancy and very rich services and make that switch do that. Now, I want to compare that to what you were just saying. If you can do all these services and all this termination in a rack of open compute servers, where do we want to go, I guess? Because to me, it makes sense to just have it all virtualized living on commodity hardware. But at the same time, there's a need for a hardware switch that's dedicated to this function that can do some of this fancy stuff as well.
I think that what we're going to see is that the next – so today what I think – and I can change my mind at any time, so bear with me because the vendors have access to a lot more information, a lot more data than we do. We're like – we just live right out here on the edge and get told whatever we have, right? But I think that software needs to go through, networking software as such needs to go through a huge change. And OpenFlow opened up the vision of controller-based networking and network management platforms. And, we'll talk about, because the second part of the Cisco announcement, of course, was the One Controller. Okay. So Cisco's One Controller is now announced, and you'll be able to go and talk to Cisco. I expect there'll be briefing. So One Controller is Cisco's network controller platform. In the same way the Big Switch, if you've tuned into the Big Switch webinar that we've had, and I've talked endlessly about network controllers, this is Cisco's controller that is now out. We now know what it will look like. We have details about how it works. So for the southbound API, it will speak OpenFlow, and will also speak Cisco's proprietary API, 1PK. And the northbound, Cisco is going to announce three applications. One is going to be network slicing, which is the ability to just pull out a bunch of paths for network flows and say, that's different from this. That's like multi-tenanting.
Yeah, multi-tenancy, yeah.
The second one was a network tap, so the ability to take a flow, duplicate it, and then send it off to a different location. So they'll have an application that can do that, which is kind of like a span, although span is within a device. What you actually want to do is you want to take a flow from that switch on the other side of the campus and divert it over here to where your packet capture engine is.
Which is kind of like what it's not kind of like, it's very much like what Gigamon and Nui and the Network Visibility Fabric people do. So that is a space to keep an eye on to see how that application develops.
So that's the second one. And then the third one was custom flow handling. So Cisco's going to produce an app which will allow you to pick out your network management flows and do something special with them, give them QoS or ultimate access. So instead of sending a particular group of flows via a given path, you can hijack the path and do it differently. You can do different routing or fancy QoS or latency monitoring of a given subset of flows from a given device.
Yeah, I found it interesting that they said define a forwarding rule around a unique parameter like low latency, because my brain said, oh, Plexi's doing that. Hmm. That's one. I mean, Plexi's got more to the story than that, but one of their rules or policies that you could apply to create what Plexi calls a network affinity was based on latency. I want to prioritize this flow and make sure it gets across the fabric as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
Since they chose that term, I was wondering if that was maybe someone that they were targeting.
It's an obvious thing to do to me. Yes. It's not. Plexi didn't invent the idea, because if you went to customers and said, what is it that you want to do? They'd say, I want to do this. You know, I need to pick out my SAP traffic and give it priority on a different path. And even on that different path, I still might share it with other things, but this flow needs to get a completely different set of handling. So, you know, if it's SAP traffic or SNMP or, you know, whatever it is that your particular pain threshold is, then that's what you need to do. That's what networking is all about, right? It's finding ways to discriminate between different traffic types and do something with it. Today, we're stuck with destination-based routing. OSPF, BGP, it just says, if you're going to this place, go down this path. It's incredibly dumb in terms of how we manage traffic with OSPF and BGP and MPLS. You can only do one thing with a given flow group.
I wouldn't say it's dumb so much as simple. It's just, it's limited in what you can do. You pick a best path and you go, and the best you can do is equal cost multipath, and there's just limited number of yep. parameters that you can feed the routing engine to determine what best path really is. It
That's
can only
right.
determine based on bandwidth, or it can only determine based on availability, link up, down, you know, these sorts of metrics. Whereas, geez, there's times where I might want to route traffic over the public internet on a VPN tunnel as opposed to across my private MPLS network for reasons other than availability.
Yeah.
My
site-to-site email traffic, right? If I've got two mail servers, why not just send that via a VPN tunnel, which costs you nothing, instead of sending it over your private WAN link?
Right.
You know? Yeah. Nobody cares if email takes 5 more minutes to get there.
Somebody could be listening and going, yeah, well, we've got policy-based routing. We can do stuff on a Cisco box with IPSLA and make some of those more intelligent decisions. Yeah, but that stuff's a pain in the butt, and it's not centralized, and you still have to do a lot of work on your part to get all that set up and functioning. I think part of the promise here with the Cisco One controller, any of the controller-based architectures, is that controller has a whole big picture of the network and is going to allow you to do create a policy and deploy it to all of your network devices that are in path and that are impacted without you having to log into all of them. That's the road we're going down. That's where things are heading. That would be nice to do.
We just need to move. You know, there's nothing wrong with where we've come from. That's where we've come from. It's like an awkward teenager. You know, the awkward teenager grows into a, you know, an adult, which can start to do more and achieve more. There's nothing wrong with where we've come from. I think we just need to move upwards and away. I'm still proud of autonomous networking in its own way, but, you know, this is where the one controller. So good to see the one controller finally arrive. One little anecdote I want to tell you about Cisco Live is I sat in on the keynote on the first day that Padmasree Warrior was giving. Now, first of all, she was dull. She was really not making it happen. And the European audience is not like an American audience, right? So in an American audience, you can say, give me a booyah, and you'll have about 25% of the audience up singing like Marines in a Hollywood movie, right? Booyah, right?
Yeah.
You should know these things, really. You know, she's done them often enough, and you really should. But so she was sort of trying to get us all excited about whatever it is she was wanging on about Cisco's 5 strategies or whatever, and it really wasn't going over well. There was a lot of shuffling and a lot of dead faces. But it was followed up by a guy who was talking about the Cisco 3850 switch, which was announced at Cisco Live in London. Basically, the Cisco 3850 is the next gen of the 3750 or the 3950, depending on who you talk about. It's the 48-port Ethernet switch, but they put the wireless LAN controller into it. And they've done a whole bunch of things. But a big part of his presentation was that he was saying, and you know, we're very excited. And then he reaches into his pocket, you know, the big reveal. And he whips out this chip, the camera, he whips out something out of his pocket. He holds it up in the air and the camera zooms in. It's a chip.
Yeah.
And everybody, you know, now if I was in San Diego, you know, when we were there, if I was in San Diego, there would have been people on their feet whooping and cheering, right? This room was dead, right? There was nothing. And then he made the mistake of the second time around, he tried to give it another go. And it really didn't work. And he said, anyway, so it was embarrassing. I left after that because it really, the whole presentation was really it was so embarrassing that I really just wanted to get the hell out. One thing I got out of that was that Cisco is really proud of its ability to cut silicon. And clearly, it is an executive choice for Cisco that they are going to continue to make and sell silicon. However, I'd also like to point out that in their 20-year history, Cisco has never made a point of selling silicon. Like, you know, when you buy your Windows laptop, there's a sticker on the bottom left-hand side to remind you that there's an Intel inside, right?
Right.
But when you buy your car, does it tell you that that's a Ford V6 M35 T2 overdrive engine inside? Nah, you don't give a toss. You know, do you care that this is the gearbox such and such, such and such that's underneath your engine? Nah, you don't give a toss. So I'm not sure that...
That's an interesting point because, as an end customer, do I really care what the ASIC is that's inside and that Cisco custom made it and baked it and all that stuff?
Huh.
I would care if that meant their switch was the only one that could do X, and maybe for a time when products first come to market, there's some period of months where their switch is the only one that can do X, but then everybody matches those capabilities. I mean, it's very hard to look at an Ethernet switch today and not look at them all and go, you know, I mean, other than power consumption, port density, what are you really buying for, you know, what are the differentiators in a lot of these things? And, you know, there's some things here and there.
Yeah,
but by and large, it's kind of like a lot of it's the same. And so, do you get excited about the silicon? does it do everything I need to do, and is it able to do it in hardware? That's what I care about. I don't care what the hardware is. Mm. I care that it can do what I need it to do in hardware. You know, there was back in the day a concern whether if you had a lot of dependency on GRE, could you terminate a GRE tunnel on a Catalyst 6500? Yeah. In hardware or software. Depending on what soup engine you bought, it made a difference.
It did.
So you pay attention to those sorts of things. But beyond that, I don't care who it's branded by. And we had John Hudson on from Brocade chatting with us. He made the point that the Brocade VDX switch line are custom Brocade ASICs, and they seem to be very proud of that as well. So it's got to be – I don't know. I think to myself, there's got to be something to it. You know, or else why put the development time into it? Why put the engineering and design time into it? Why not just, you know, put all that, hey, Intel, hey, Broadcom, whoever, I'm going to buy a chip from you guys. I needed to do X.
Like, it is a differentiator, right? So Cisco is most likely going to be one of the few vendors still cutting their own silicon in the years to come. So it's a differentiator, and they certainly should market the hell out of it, in my view. But you haven't been doing it for the last 15 years. You can't just suddenly burst onto the scene and expect everybody to
pull a chip out of your pocket and plop.
Yeah. And I just wonder if that needs work. Cisco needs to make a big effort to focus on that. But I don't think the flip side of that is that the brutal reality is that Cisco's not one company. It's actually about 12 or 15. Each one of the business units has their own strategy. Like, there's the big five divisions, you know, there's the borderless networks and there's the video conferencing, but inside each of those, there's lines of business, right? So for Cisco to actually say, we are a silicon company, we're a hardware company, requires a whole company effort. And Cisco doesn't have a whole company vision. It has five big visions, and then it has 14 or 15 business units that do product visions in each one of those categories. And unlike Intel, right? So Intel makes CPUs, and it's like 60 or 70% of the revenue comes from CPUs. So it's very easy for that business unit to stand up and put a sticker on every Windows laptop saying, Intel inside, bum, 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 you know, whatever.
Right.
You know? But for Cisco to stand up and put a Cisco Silicon inside sticker on the outside is going to go down like a, you know, like a fart in a wetsuit. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I can see how it can work. It is a strength. Having control of your own silicon means your devices. It also, from my point of view, Cisco is going to defend their hardware capability. So their existing asset, their strength is, and there's lots of customers who, like you and I, are talking about all these software ideas. But they're going to be years before they reach any sort of wide stream adoption outside of weird people like us who dream of odd ways of doing things, right? So Cisco wants to hold on to its existing market share and, you know, doesn't want customers to turn away from software and start using VMware's vShield Edge, which delivers 70% of the functionality of a Cisco router for free, right? So, and even better, it adds controller magic sauce to it because vCloud Ops actually orchestrates the deployment and the provisioning of that firewall load balancer routing device inside of there. It's a real... Cisco needs to do something about that. That I can see that Cisco feels that they need to do something about it. Whether they're going about it the right way or not, it remains to be seen.
There is going to be a sales presentation that folks are going to be able to listen to in the coming years where what's going to be sold to them is the entire network in a box. And what the switches are and what the routers are isn't what's going to be sold. Those may be the components you need to buy or to license, as the case may be. But those are going to be line items on a SKU. What you're going to be buying is a big package of application, controller, and network components that do what you need it to do, whether that's enterprise, data center, cloud. I think that's really where things are going. The fact that the network is made up of all of these ports, the fact that the network may have custom silicon inside that enables this functionality, that's nice, that's there, but that's not going to be the sell. The sell is going to be, if you put a network engine in place, if you will, think of it that way, here's the functionality that it's going to have. Okay, you need to build out a new VLAN. Well, let me show you how it works. It works like this. You log into this application, you build the VLAN, you assign a policy to it, and then the controller deploys it to the appropriate switches. Well, which switches? It doesn't matter. It knows where you need it to go because that was all set up and defined when you brought the network engine in-house.
Well, that's exactly what I'm doing today. We create in the vCloud app, we create a thing called a virtual data center, which actually spans multiple data centers, physical data centers. And then inside of that, we have a provider virtual data center, which is location A and location B. And then you can actually start creating a thing called a vApp, which is basically a group of templates. You click a button and it deploys an app. And it creates the VXLANs. So you don't use VLAN IDs. You draw a VLAN.
Yeah,
you draw a VLAN ID from the pool. So every time we sign up a new customer, you allocate a new VLAN. And then that gives you another 4,096 VXLAN IDs for that customer. And then the VXLAN kicks into place then. So that VLAN comes with a multicast configuration. The VXLAN lays over the top. And that whole customer then has got 4,096 VXLANs in a given data center to just start deploying stuff in. VMware comes with the vShield Edge, which does routing, load balancing, and firewalling, albeit a little bit simple. But it's going to be pretty easy for VMware to keep updating those things because they're software. They can just ship version 5.1.1 of the vSphere Edge appliance, and I'll just go through my network and reboot them all and update them, right? And I don't need to wait for, you know, to cut a flash image and then the customer downloads it and wait for a change window. It's just a piece of software that I just reboot the VM. Within 5 seconds, it's rebooted and it's back up. And I've got to, and because it's in a VM, I can snapshot the previous version. And if the new version does something weird, I just turn it off and roll back to the previous VM and work out what went wrong. That's a continuous delivery cycle to me.
My viewpoint is always from the enterprise, and I keep thinking that so much of the process that I have to deal with in my day-to-day work is we're still a fragmented and siloed group of people doing individual tasks, that you just know the technology is right there and or coming soon to be able to automate so much of this so that engineers that working in an IT group could start working on design and architecture as opposed to day-to-day operations.
Yeah, that's true. So let's just touch on that, because every time we talk about these things, people send us emails saying, should I be worried about being a network engineer? The answer is no. Right. We're still talking networking here. We're still talking routers and firewalls and SSL VPNs and MPLS, and you'll still need to know all of that technology. It just won't be twitching your fingers at the CLI of a router like we used to have it. It'll be, you'll spend more time delivering real value to the business than you did before.
Yeah, but you'll still have troubleshooting exercises to go through. I mean, you'll have to figure out why on this VXLAN termination point, it ain't working right because who knows what. You know, there'll still be bugs to resolve, and there'll still be links in the core that that aren't, you know, ECMP wasn't set up right and isn't working properly, or you know, whatever. But a lot of that stuff, that day-to-day kind of stuff that might occupy your time today, should really just go away. You have to think about it. You can think about bigger problems to solve.
Yeah, that's right. So you should be thinking about how can I tune up my load balancing algorithms, or one thing that you could think of with is instead of deploying a new firewall in your company next time, consider whether you could deploy a vSphere box, not a vCloud, but just a vSphere, and run that firewall on an ESX host and see if you could bring that in and start learning how to manage that yourself. So could you build enough VMware skills? It doesn't take much to do that, by the way. to just, you know, instantiate a VMware, it's actually very easy to install. And consider running it. The licensing fees are about as expensive as the cost of a... So the cost of a server would be about $3,000. The cost of the VMware license for a single for a pair of servers, you know, you'd need two to have your HA. It's about the same price as a pair of ASA 5520s to do it in VMs. And then have a look around for a firewall license, which might be the extra cost. And then look at running, I don't know, maybe a Viada or a Cisco has a bunch. There's the Juniper SRX. There's a virtual version of that that you could use. Mm-hmm. And maybe there's a point in your network where you could start to look at this and say, this is how I could, a non-core, non-critical PC business, and maybe start to put that together and work out how to do that. You'd be surprised at how cost-effective that is. And then consider what could happen if you had 20 of those servers running all of your networking appliances.
I've got a set of firewalls at one particular site that I keep adding VLANs to the DMZ interface and creating new unique DMZ interfaces, just the, you know, the nature of a particular topology that we're deploying on this physical firewall. And it's silly. All of the virtual machines, or all of the machines that are actually living in those DMZs, are virtual machines living on a VMware cluster. And why am I pumping all of this traffic through this physical firewall? It just, the only thing that hasn't been virtualized in the infrastructure is the firewall itself.
Yes. And the security is possibly something that we'll talk about in a future show, because I'm now working on security strategies to do in that sort of environment. And I've got all sorts of crazy ideas, but I think most of them are probably wrong, so I'll probably avoid them talking about today. So there's one more thing. There was a blog post this week talking about Amazon. And I think this is really interesting from a business point of view. This person was basically pointing out, I can't remember the actual link. I'll have to try and look it up and put it in the show notes. But this guy was writing and saying that Amazon makes very, very thin margins on their products for their cloud, which is a very useful business tool because it precludes, it basically prevents people from starting up in business against them. Like if you want to set up a cloud, you need a lot of capital. And because Amazon keeps reducing the price of their products, it's actually very hard to compete with them. Like Cisco charges $1 million for everything that they do. They charge generously for all of their software and their hardware. And so it makes it very easy for other companies to come along and compete with them because they can have start, at least in the early days, by having something based on a competitive price. Whereas Amazon goes completely the other way and says, no, we're always trying to strive for cheapness. But what I wanted to do, that's sort of obvious, but what it also does is that inside Amazon, that focus on cheap, low margin, and efficient business means that they also have no salespeople and no fancy executives. So you can't ring up Amazon and say, send me out a salesperson to keep to tell me about your product. Salespeople are expensive, right? For Amazon, a salesperson is a cost. For legacy businesses, a salesperson is a profit center because they bring money through the door. But for Amazon, they say, no, no, our business is about efficiency. What we learn is what we do is we focus absolutely and utterly on having the most efficient business. We can make profits by making our business more efficient, by squeezing more out of our hard drives, using less power, delivering faster, adding more features to our core product. But we don't make money by adding salespeople or executives to the team.
And so the product, therefore, has to sell itself, and the way that they keep it selling itself is continually driving the price down.
Yeah. I really want to work at Amazon right now. No salespeople, right? No business people who are off on a tangential thing saying, you know, one of our customers has asked to have hot dancing girls delivered with their training program. You know, you laugh, right? But it's not. You know, I was in meetings with customers the other day, and they expected that I'm building these clouds, and I'm sitting here with customers and product managers, and I'm gathering their requirements, and I'm going, yeah, you know what? I am just going to build an alien spaceship, and it'll all do it for you, right? But Amazon doesn't do that. They say, this is what we do. We're an engineering company. We focus on engineering and being massively efficient. And they just do that. They don't spend a lot of time explaining their products to customers. If the customers don't know what they want, then they don't want Amazon. Customers who buy Amazon know what they want because it's the most efficient, it's the fastest, it's the most, yeah.
Yeah, the sales cycle is as much as the web page that explains the service and the pricing. Want it? Here, click here and sign up. Here you go.
That's right. Yeah. But it's that to me, that's one of the unique features of a cloud, is that you don't actually have salespeople. You don't want executives doing product management and customers management, because that's what IT people do.
It's always been astonishing to me how much money salespeople make, because as an engineer who's worked very hard to maintain difficult technical skills and has a lot of stress in job and so on, and then I know what I've made over the years, and then you look at a salesperson and what they make, and usually it's a heck of a lot more than I've been able to work out. So it's always been amazing to me the cost that a business incurs by having a sales force to get out there and push product. So it's interesting that Amazon has proven, no, you don't have to do it that way.
It goes right in the face of an MBA graduate who will tell you that you don't need a product. You just need something to sell. You sell and you make revenue. And in fact, the best of all worlds is you're actually selling something that you don't make, because you're making money out of nothing at that point. And what Amazon's doing is turning that on its head. And that's why Amazon's share price is actually quite high, is because they are actually doing something innovative in terms of they continue to make, Amazon makes profits by making their process more efficient, or their, making their EC2 run faster or better, and they get ahead of the competition for a period of time before they have to innovate again.
I just had a moment here thinking, well, what was Amazon when it started? Oh, they sold books. Oh, Amazon, they got any book in the world. You can go up there on Amazon and get it. And then think how the last, I don't know how many years it's been, decade maybe, and what Amazon has become. It really says something about vision and leadership, people that have an idea in their mind of where they think the company can go and then can take them there. That is, considering the number of companies we've seen fail, that is quite an achievement.
Correct. Amazon showing you that you don't need salespeople to sell a product. And I feel quite inspired by that. I feel that that's a lesson for the world to learn. I do have some other things to talk about, but I think we might have gone on for long enough. What do you think?
We rattled on for 90 minutes, just about.
Gee, Lizikins. What are we like?
How does that happen? I had an interesting email from someone who was interested in us doing a basic introduction to the concepts of network virtualization and overlay networks, which is something we have glossed over a bit, although we've done some rudimentary discussion as well. But that might not be a bad show for us to do at some point. And there's no lack of things to talk about. I was talking to Omar Sultan at Cisco over email, asking him a few questions about the Cisco One controller and how it accomplishes a few things. And he gave me some great information. I just responded back, geez, I love networking. It's just such a great time to be in this business with all the technology changes, what's happening, the visions that people have, the business needs that people have, that networking engineers are rising up to deliver and to help solve those problems. It's just a way cool time to be in the business, and I love it.
This is a great time to be in networking. And I understand that some people might feel that, networking is changing beyond their comprehension of how it's going. But networking is networking, packets to packets, frames to frames. And over the years, I've been working on minis and mainframes and micros and all sorts of different things. And this is just another transition. I don't imagine that it's going to be any more traumatic than any of the older ones. I can't see why it would be.
No, and I do see a new way of doing networking kind of beginning to form and settle, and I think we're going to see controller-based network architectures come to be a normal thing, and that's going to happen within the next, let's say, 5 to 10 years, where that'll be the expected infrastructure. That's going to be what's normal. And all of us that do network for a living, we'll probably do a bit of virtualization too, we'll probably understand controllers and programming a little bit more. And yeah, it's going to change and shift, and we'll roll with it.
Well, we all used to know. I mean, I remember back in the late 90s, we all used to program in Perl. We used to do a lot of network automation in Perl because the features in the routing protocols weren't there. And it was quite...
I spent a lot of time digging around on CPAN looking for certain modules that would help me accomplish whatever it was. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And, I'm already now looking at tools like Puppet to automatically provision network appliances in a cloud. So I would actually just, you know, have predetermined configurations of routers and firewalls and stuff, click a button, and Puppet would do an automated deployment of those things. Puppet is a, for those of you not familiar with Puppet, Puppet is a configuration system that you can basically write a template for anything, and it will just build a device according to those steps.
And was just bought by VMware, I believe, right? Puppet Labs.
VMware threw some money at it to get a bigger stake in it. It's a very big part of VMware.
Didn't buy it, but yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so something I'm involved in right now is we're actually building vClouds. So we're actually building an entire data center in a bunch of, what data center we mean, like, we buy vBlocks today. So we actually get the whole, everything in a package. And what we actually want to do is to automate the provisioning of that entire set of racks into one button. So Puppet would deploy the entire, you know, go along, upgrade the 5500s, upgrade the storage arrays, upgrade, then start deploying the VMware software onto each of the hosts. It might take 24 hours to go through the provisioning process, but we want to be able to roll out a data center, you know, a whole new rack of a VMware vCloud within a week. We need to be deploying one a week.
And Puppet would basically make it a turnkey, get it to the point where you needed to be at to deliver, start delivering your applications.
Yeah, you can't roll out a vBlock if you're doing the manual clicking yourself, and we need to be delivering one per week, so we actually need to be automating that whole base build of installing ESX and then installing vSphere and installing vCloud, and then installing all of the firewalls and the appliances and the networking setup. The whole front end needs to just come out of the box, ready to go. Complicated, right? And hard, and it's going to take us a while to get there, but those are the sorts of ideas that some people are working on outside of what the existing infrastructures are doing today. Anyway, we should just basically wrap this up. So,
yes, we should.
Yeah, well, that's it for the show this week, and thanks for listening to Packet Pushers. We should get back to you again in a week or so make sure you come back. I'd like to thank our external resources, but we didn't have any, so I'd like to thank Ethan.
Yeah. And follow me on Twitter at EC Banks. I'm also doing more blogging and more writing on network computing as well. And I'll tweet out those links as my content gets published. I get a lot of feedback from listeners, comments, and tweets and retweets, and I appreciate those things.
And I'm Greg Farrow. You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com. Also on the Twitter as at etherealmind, and I'm also on app.net. If you follow me on app.net, you'll actually get a far more raw version of me. It's where I actually post my inner dialogue. It's disturbing and slightly immoral, but you're welcome to join along there too. As always, you can check out the show notes related to today's show by getting along to the Packet Pushers website at packetpushers.net. You can follow the Packet Pushers on the Twitter feed to get updates and information about what's happening at Packet Pushers from Twitter at Packet Pushers. Don't forget that there's a forum at forum.packetpushers.net where we actually have long grown-up discussions, bigger than 140 characters. Which is always appreciated, and we do actually patrol there on a regular basis. A big thanks to the bloggers who've been blogging on Packet Pushers recently, and thanks so much for listening to us this week, because you need to remember that too much networking would never be enough.